Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to Pod Sequentialism. I am your host, Matt Kennedy. Pod Sequentialism, of course, grew out of the Pop Sequentialism Exhibitions catalog and traveling show. You can visit Pop Sequentialism online at popsequentialism.com. If you want to follow this podcast and our various social media, you can do so at PodSec, P-O-D-S-E-Q, on Instagram and Twitter. You can go to the Pod Sequentialism page on Facebook. Saying pod and pop, I know it's confusing. It's the way we like it over here. And as you know, we record every week basically here at Meltdown Comics and Collectibles. Often they have a lot of interesting things going on. Generally, when we're taping here on Sundays, they've got a lot of gaming going on with tabletop D&D and stuff like that. And there's a lot of guilds, and then there's a lot of Nerdist stuff that goes on. So you can stop in and have a good time pretty much any time at Meltdown. We also want to give a shout out to La Luz de Jesus Gallery, which I'm actually setting up the coaster show, our annual over 1,000 piece extravaganza that we do every September because I'm a masochist. And all of the pieces are about 4 inches, not about, they're exactly 4 inches, and they're either Tondo, which is round or square, and some of the best artists working in contemporary pop participate in the show. It's a maximum price of $250 on any coaster, and some of the coasters are free. So it's one of those events that we get a ton of people into. We're going to have Fort Point pouring the beer this year and Sino Tequila as well. Don't overdo it. Come for the art. Stay for the drinks. And also, of course, within the realm of La Luz de Jesus Gallery is Wacko and Soap Plant. And that's actually part of what brings today's guest to the show is that Jordan is the son of one of my coworkers, actually, Lydia Breckenridge, and also his dad, Jeffrey Mantor, is the owner of Larry Edmonds Bookshop, which is the last remaining collectible shop in Hollywood. And it's been around for decades. It was when we were all at Hollywood Book and Poster once in the day. It was our neighbor on the same block. We would send people there back and forth. They would do the same. Great people. Still has a great collection of archival posters and contemporary books. They do a lot of great signings with filmmakers and contemporary scholars. But before we get into talking to Jordan, I want to give a little bit of time to S.J. Harris, with Threader 24 Racing, who died on the set of Deadpool 2. Ms. Harris was the first African-American female professional road racer. She was a stunt double for Zazie Beetz. And, of course, anytime a stunt person dies on a set, there have been a few in the last year and a half. It's cause for great sadness. I know that a lot of these people would rather die doing what they love than not, and doing some of the incredible, difficult to choreograph stunt work is part of the draw for a dangerous way of making a living. But you know, I think it's perhaps doubly upsetting in this case, considering some of the controversy about the casting of the person who she was doubling on screen in the particular role that she has. And now we, of course, all want the film to be incredible to justify the senseless death of one of its key participants. So best of luck to the cast and crew and the family members connected to Deadpool 2. Looking forward to seeing the film. Very interested in looking to see how they integrate Domino into this film. So welcome to the show, Jordan.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So this is kind of great. I love, one of the great things about this show is that, you know, we schedule people and people drop out of the schedule, and then it's sometimes easy to pull somebody in and say, hey, can you cover for this? And we really love to have you on the show. And other times it's just me talking for 40 minutes, and the fact that people still tune in, it makes me really, really happy. But why I thought you'd be great to talk to is for a couple of reasons. That we've done a show before with Chris Sapp about being the second generation of fandom. Mm. And so, you know, we mentioned that your mom works at Wacko. She's one of the managers here at the shop where La Luz de Jesus is. She was also very important part of Los Angeles punk scene. She was in the Boneheads and was also in the Bags for a little bit. She was a roadie for the Cramps. And in a scene in the late 70s, especially the punk scene, which was predominantly, if you think of the English punk scene, predominantly white working class to middle class punks. The LA scene was a little bit different because it was a little bit more color, but it was just a little bit. Mm. So there was like the Latino bands from East LA, like the Plugs, and you had from San Diego the Elvez's first band, not the Wackos. But you know, there's quite a few Latin punk bands, but there weren't a lot of African Americans in punk in the late 70s. Mm. And to be a woman and to be an African American who was in a punk band is, you know, breaking some real ground. And I love hearing the tales that your mom tells about the punk scene. I know they're few and far between.
Yeah.
But it's also interesting because you're the first person I've had on the show that had two musician parents. And you, of course, you were acting out of high school, and you ended up going in a slightly different career path. But talk to me a little bit about that. You know, what was it about growing up in a household with a fairly important collectible authority like Jeffrey, and with an important punk rocker like Lydia?
You know, it's funny because talking about their interests like this, it's funny how growing up, how good they were in certain respects about not bringing a lot of that home with them.
Yeah.
You know, my dad brought the movie stuff home in the form of, you know, watching movies, talking about movies, in taking various forms of media in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the actual collector stuff, you know, expensive books, scripts, signed stuff, memorabilia that, you know, literally thousands of at the store, there wasn't a lot of that in the house.
Right.
So it was almost more of a treat to go in there every day whenever I wanted to look at this stuff and read it and like have carte blanche fit almost.
Note to collectors, this is the way to do that if you can. If you can keep all that stuff outside of where you sleep, it's amazing.
It would have just ended up ruined. I would have just ran my fingers all through it. But, you know, having it divorced on that level was really beneficial for me because having that level of separation also, it gave me a space to flourish creatively.
Right.
Having a separate place to sort of articulate my thoughts on all of that.
And not get hammered with it.
Which
can happen. I mean, you see at the conventions, you've got the parents that have their kids dressed in Star Trek costumes. And you sort of hope they like Star Trek. I hope they grow up to enjoy it and not hate it. But, and what about the music aspect? Was that kind of, I think a lot of people who get involved in music do so for performance sake of one way or another. Mm-hmm. And so do you think that that had any kind of quiet influence on you wanting to be a performer at a certain point?
Possibly. I didn't really have information on what specifically my parents even did. I knew that my mother was a, you know, quote musician, unquote, and my dad was like a quote musician, unquote, up until like a certain age, probably like teenage years or something. It was just like, it was a hobby. I didn't really understand the intensity of which they were in the scene.
Right.
Really. But as I got older, and you know, you get older, you hear more stories of varying vulgarities and everything. You know, it just sounds a lot more interesting. My dad was in, you know, a few various outfits. I know Sunset Strip. I forget the name of the venue. Not Sardi's, because that's for New York.
Right, but, right. Well, was Jeffrey like a jazz musician?
No, actually. He was actually a rock and roll guy. Okay. He moved here originally with a buddy from Reno, Nevada. That was his hometown.
So I'm sure he played the whiskey or he played like the
Roxy. He definitely played. He has stories about whiskey for sure.
Yeah.
Basic venues, a few of which aren't there anymore. Decline of Western Civilization. Yeah. I'm sure you can catch a few of those in there. But
the country club.
Yeah. And in the same respect, like my dad was good for movie stuff. My mom was good with that music stuff too, because my mom has a very wide, varying range of what she listens to, and you kind of piecemeal together what you like, what you don't like. But all the punk stuff that I got.
Well, now she just plays your iPod.
Well, it's a few years old though. That selection's been updated a few times since then, I'm sure.
Now you did a little bit of acting, and you didn't enjoy it, or you just didn't feel like you had a capacity for it?
You know, it's funny. Reflecting on it a little bit more as I get older and I'm not doing it so much every day. It's funny how, like, just starting from the age of 5, which is when I started doing it, to about 17, 18, to which I stopped. There's various child actors that flourish and do very well, and various actors that maybe don't even take off as children but continue and develop into adult actors
right.
who are able to, like, take that sense of, you know, whether it's rejection or necessarily, you know, dissatisfaction of what you're doing, they're able to channel that and turn it into a more comprehensive way of doing what they want to do in terms of acting. And
right.
It was just a step I was missing.
Yeah.
And it was frustrating, especially in high school, you know, doing shows. And even in my senior year, I was the lead of a show.
Yeah.
And, you know, I won an award. It wasn't a big award, but it was like an informal young arts award for that. And just seeing other actors who I knew were better and were just way more dedicated and hadn't had rejection just pounded into them year after year. But still loving the nature of making films and watching and consuming that art form.
Right.
It led to me wanting to, like, you know, maybe I want to writing movies, having a different lens into that just seems more appealing.
Which is something we have in common.
Yeah.
In that I didn't start as young because I didn't move out here until I was in my late teens and started acting by accident, you know, sort of, you know, pulled out of Soap Plant, actually, by Mel Brooks.
Oh, wow.
But, and started acting for a while, but I didn't love it. And I think that if I had been doing more theater type stuff, I might have enjoyed it a lot more. Mm-hmm. But those casting calls, you know, those big cattle call ones where it's like 7-Up or Mountain Dew was the big one, where you've got like 400 people in a room
Definitely.
And they don't hit the time that they gave you to give, that you're supposed to read. And you do like 5 of those a day.
No,
you know,
for definitely
months at a time. And if you don't book something, you start to get serious self-doubt. And I think a lot of people who haven't been actors in the capacity of it being your job, which means that you have to go to as many casting calls as your agent sends you on, that they don't understand the process, and it can be very dehumanizing.
Oh, absolutely.
And I stopped going on auditions when I got called into a casting where the casting agent asked me to take my shirt off, and I didn't feel comfortable. I didn't know that that was part of the job.
Right.
I never saw that commercial happen, so I'm not sure what the thing was. And so it made me understand how hard it must be for you know, women actors.
Oh, absolutely.
That it's like that they get this all the time. And that really opened my eyes, and I'm like, wow, you know, I was more interested in writing. I had already been a rewrite guy and had done some other behind-the-scenes stuff. And I took it as an opportunity to spend more time on sets doing other things and learned about gripping and learned about lighting and audio and all that jazz, which helped when I became a producer because I knew if someone wasn't doing something right. But you ended up becoming much more involved in that kind of back end of the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things, and I remember when you first left town, you know, that you got a job with Alamo Drafthouse.
Correct.
And so part of their training program was to send everybody at that point to Texas to learn every aspect of the job.
Mm-hmm.
And they would figure out where they felt your strengths were and then put you in the right position.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened and how did that happen?
You know, bear in mind, I did sign a confidentiality agreement about a lot of us. So there's only so much I can get into.
Sure.
But, you know, a lot of it really has to do less with the company, any of their goals, any of their aspirations, any of their intentions, and more like myself and my strengths as a manager and as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Alamo Drafthouse is a very esteemed, appreciated brand, the high volume of that sort of stuff.
Yeah. ArcLight being the most familiar thing to people in L.A. that don't know
people around here, yeah. I know IPIC has some stuff here and there, but I'm not entirely sure.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, just the crossover, let me articulate myself, but the level of volume that you just go through on a day-to-day basis and just dealing with that many people ritually, it sort of divorces you from the more creative aspects of what I want to do. And once again, that's not the company, that's more me. I'm not a numbers guy.
Right.
I'm never going to be a CEO. I'm not like an entrepreneurial sort of dude. I'm a guy that put me in a room, give me a piece of paper, tell me something to write. I'll write it, give me a camera, I'll shoot it.
You know,
I'm more I can give you something tangible on that level. And, you know, I'm still think I'm a good manager.
An executable technician.
You know, yeah, I'm a free agent. I can't undersell myself too much. But,
right.
You know.
But yeah. I think what's interesting is that you were a very important part of setting up the Brooklyn Alamo Draft House. And now it's great when I get to talk to someone here in L.A. that has... And because it's a podcast and people listen to it all over the place, and we hope we have listeners in New York City, that there will be people that will be more familiar with that situation than I am with the person that I know better than they know,
you know?
Which I hope that articulates well to ears without my hand gesturing. But that part of that, I mean, how long were you in New York when you were doing the setup and you stayed there and you realized, okay, well, wow, this is a lot of volume. This is a high volume business.
Yeah, you know, I touched down in New York for a job in June after a few months of training. And, you know, we went through, you know, the feeling out period, you know, pre-opening, all that jazz, end up opening in late October, at which point, you know, think of late October. If you're a movie guy, you know, the movie schedule, you can think of how usually the movie situation ramps up for that winter season.
You're out of the blockbusters, but you're into like the franchises.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the award films.
Yeah, late October, early November. And last year, early November was Doctor Strange. That was our first big movie. But bear in mind, you also had Moonlight, and you also had a really great underrated film if you haven't seen The Handmaiden.
Right.
Got a lot
great,
of buzz.
The Korean film, yeah.
Yeah, if you haven't seen that, I'd definitely recommend that. We opened with that too.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you cater to that many people, all walks of life are going to come at once to see what they want to see.
Yeah.
And with the added benefit of, you know, the whole movie, drink, and the atmosphere.
For those who don't know, Alamo Draft House serves beer.
Yeah.
So that's what we're dancing around here. And hard alcohol.
Yeah.
And so you get a slightly more, I'm just going to say it, belligerent crowd on occasion.
Occasionally.
And I know that at Alamo that's much less common than it might otherwise be. And that part of the system that they have in place is to have security and people that kind of oversee. You guys aren't above pulling somebody out of the seat and throwing them out.
No, it's never the first option. It's never something we want to glorify. I'm saying we, because like I do not work with a company anymore. Let's
make
it clear. But you know, formally, it's not something that the company enjoys to do.
Right.
But we give them every opportunity to like don't talk. They get the warning.
Yep.
And then they're respectfully asked to leave at a certain point because we got to take the value of every guest into account.
But it's also enforcement of the contract between the viewer and the screen.
Correct.
That if people know that they can actually get kicked out for not behaving, they generally behave better.
No, and that's flat out stated because, you know, no business should be in the business of just chucking people out with giving them fair warning or a set of the rules. Alamo does the same thing.
Yeah.
It's stated multiple times. You walk through any venue. I can go in there as a guest right now and get thrown out for the exact same thing.
Exactly.
It's totally non-discriminatory in that sense.
Well, cool. Well, this has been a short kind of window into other careers that can happen that are related to the entertainment business. And what I think is great, again, is that a lot of times what's great about pursuing the arts is that you don't necessarily find yourself in the position that you aimed for, but you find yourself in the position that you're geared for. And sometimes people don't understand how many middle steps there can be, which is great. People who are looking to prolong their involvement with the arts can do so in a lot of different capacities that may not be as immediately rewarding, but are great stepping stones. I have to imagine that with all of the filmmaker screenings that got hosted at Alamo Draft House, that you had quite a bit of interaction with very interesting, very talented people who, like the general public, can cover a very wide swath of awesome people and people that you wish were more awesome, and that can be used as a stepping stone moving forward, that you get to ask questions by proximity, that you have proximity in a different capacity than the general public because you're a paid professional to be in this place, and that you can kind of pick the brains of people that you respect. And so as somebody who's, as you've stated, who's more interested in writing and directing and that type of stuff, that this job that you had at Alamo Draft House gave you a better toolbox than some people have with their professors in film school.
I would, you know, in certain respects, I would agree to that. Definitely on a management level. I think, like they say, the old axiom is if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere.
Yeah.
And applying to workload if you get real heavy into what you want to do and you accomplish it, you will be given the opportunity to do it at the highest level there.
Right.
More so than maybe anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that is going to go with me. I don't know what I'm doing next, but whether it's creative or in a more tangible, you know, workplace environment, you know, that it's, you got to learn from experience no matter what you do. And that's something that it's incredibly hard to just overlook. I'm going to remember that forever.
Right. Perfect. Well, shout out some social media.
Oh, you know, I don't have a whole lot going on. I'm probably going to reopen my Instagram just for this. It's at Half Dark Knight.
Mm-hmm.
And the Facebook, you can just, I don't have any, you know, non-public page. If you want to follow me, feel free to follow me. I got jokes for days, but...
And that's Jordan Mantor, yeah. J-O-R-D-A-N-M-A-N-T-O-R. And excellent, man. Thanks for filling in on this this quick episode of Podsequentialism.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
And we'll have you back on a roundtable. I think that'd be great.
Oh, I'd love to be here. When and where, man.
Excellent. So once again, I want to thank everybody, and especially my producer, Mason. And want to remind people again, you can catch us on social media at Podsec, P-O-D-S-E-Q, and that advertisers, you too, can reach this prime demographic. Hello, this is Matt Kennedy from Pod Sequentialism, and what many of you may know that I do run a gallery in Los Angeles called La Luz de Jesus Gallery. And what you may not know is that it's inside Wacko, which is probably the greatest center of pop culture in the world. And it may sound like hyperbole, it's not. You can, if you don't want to trust my judgment, you can listen to people like Kevin Smith, James Gunn, David Mack, all of whom will swear that one of their favorite places on earth is Wacko, the shop that houses La Luz de Jesus Gallery. Whether it's blind box toys or little tchotchkes or art books, it pretty much is the place that you can get all of your Christmas shopping done for every possible annoying person to buy for that you can imagine. They've got everything, and I highly recommend that you visit them. You can visit them online at soapplant.com. You can visit the gallery at laluzdejesus.com, and that's spelled LaLuzDeJesus.com. Check them out and tell them Matt Kennedy sent you.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.